Hello and welcome. In this one-off episode recorded at St. Joseph's Hospice, we pay tribute to our late friend Jay McLaughlin, who bravely battled cancer until his final days in July of this year. Interviewed by John Greenwood, Jay's heartfelt account covers a range of topics from his cherished childhood memories and school days to his fulfilling career as a master photographer. With candid reflections on the profound influence of family and love in his life, Jay's story becomes a poignant reminder to seize every moment and embrace the beauty of existence. Join us as we celebrate the life and legacy of Jay McLaughlin, a source of inspiration to us all.
James, we're here in the, here in the garden. Jay. At St. Joseph's Hospice. The weather's a bit changeable, actually, because this morning we've had a real good old downpour, I think. I mean, a lot of people will breathe a sigh of relief because it's been so dry recently and hot. But anyway, we've had that. And the sky is a little bit grey, but anyway, we're going to risk it.
Risk it for a biscuit.
You've come out in your T-shirt, so that's a good sign. And I was just asking you about the tattoo that you've got on the inside of your arm. Now, what's all that about? It's a do you want to hold that?
I will hold this.
Okay. If you just in the normal way, speaking it. So, James, tell me about that. Jay, tell me about that tattoo you've got. It's a bluebird.
It's a swallow. Ah, it's a swallow. I believe I'm not. Was it an ornithologist or a twitcher? So I'm an Olympus ambassador, Olympus camera ambassador, and we were doing a prank for April Fools where we were pretending to get the Olympus brand tattooed on our bodies, and it was all a bit of fun and games, and got to the end of it and had made out that we got these Olympus tattoos on our arms. Of course we hadn't, but and one of the girls said, oh, I bet you wouldn't get a real one. And we had these temporary tattoo sheets, and one of them was a swallow holding this little heart, and I was like, well, I'll get that one. And the story behind why sailors have, or at least the story I've been told about why sailors have this swallow tattoo, is that they carry this heart around, and the heart signifies home. And however far the swallow will get, because they're migratory, it will always be able to find its way home. And I liked that story of because especially at the time, my job involved quite a lot of travelling, and so I liked the idea of, you know, however far away I get from wherever I call home, I can find my way back.
Follow the bluebird.
Swallow.
The swallow, of course. But as I said, the connection with Olympus we'll talk about in a little while, and your career in photography, of course. So tell me a little bit about yourself. It's Jay, not James.
Officially, according to the birth register, is James. My father is also James. His father was James. His father was James. There's quite a few Jameses. I don't even know how many.
And James McLaughlin?
Yeah, James McLaughlin. I know more about the last name than where the first name came from. The first name, so it's James Scott McLaughlin. Like I say, my dad and his dad, and goes all up, although they all tended to be Jim, and I never fit being a Jim. And when I was very young, Mum was so petrified of me being Jim again, that they called me Jamie when I was very little. So anyone that knows me from a very young age will often call me Jamie, but the last name, as far as I'm aware, is Scottish and translates to the son of Lachlan. And Lachlan was a name that was given to a stranger from the land of lakes. Loch being lake in Scottish, and land being land. And it was often given to a Viking. So theoretically, I am the son of a Viking, which I often attribute to why I can grow quite a nice beard.
It does look rather impressive.
Needs a trim.
So when you were born, it was your dad or your mum who fought it out about what you were going to be called?
I don't think there was a fight. I think it was just something that was
it's in the family, and that's the way it's going to be.
Yeah. I've never had that discussion that I recall. Maybe they fought over my brother's name. I don't know.
Land of Lakes, or maybe Scandinavia somewhere, the Viking tradition. But you're a London chap, are you?
I'm from Buckinghamshire. Well, technically I'm from Slough, but although I was born in Ascot because mum and dad didn't want me to be born in Slough. I can't argue with that. So I had the first year of my life in Slough, and then I was raised in Buckinghamshire, and then moved to London in 2012.
And are you one of a big family, or lots of brothers and sisters? Or
just got one younger brother, he lives out near Reading, working in the car industry, we get on. We have a lot of similar interests, both children of the 80s, that's our small but perfectly formed family.
Were you in that part of the world because of your father's job or something like that?
So both mum and dad are from Liverpool. However, they never knew each other when they were in Liverpool. Mm. Dad's a little bit older than mum, so when mum got her job, and this was getting a job, they both worked for British Airways, and getting a job as a stewardess was a big thing back then. And mum worked in a florist, and the newsagent opposite said, "Oh, you might meet our nephew. He works for British Airways, so maybe you'll go down there to London and you'll meet him." And mum's like, "Well, British Airways is a big company. The odds of us meeting are quite small." Of course, not only did they meet, they fell in love and got married and had babies. So that was an amusing thing to have happened, so they obviously both moved down south from Liverpool for their careers, and then, like I say, they chose not to continue living in Slough.
Does it ever cross your mind that a different set of circumstances, you might have been born as a Scouser?
I quite possibly would have been.
Which would give you a whole different outlook on life, I'm sure.
A different accent, too.
Mm. But probably sort of like a slightly cheeky nature. I think Liverpool people are full of jokes and witticisms, rather cheeky, but
I'm
in your face.
I'm not cheeky, ever. I don't do cheekiness. Cheekiness is... that's not me, ever.
But I'm sure, being a professional photographer, and we'll get onto that in a minute, but you have to sort of have a distinct idea about people you're talking to, perhaps people you're going to be working with, and models perhaps you're photographing?
I mean, yeah, people are fascinating to me in so many ways, and especially the way that people relate to other people. It's interesting because my partner, one of the reasons that we... struck a bond quite quick. So being British, we suck at languages. We're not very good at speaking the tongues of other places. So I made it a point, being someone who sucks at languages, to learn how to say thank you in as many different languages as I could. Mm. And I got up to over 30 different languages of being able to say thank you. So when I met my partner, she was quite surprised that I knew how to say thank you in Hungarian.
She's Hungarian.
She could have been French, but she would just been surprised that I knew how to say it in Hungarian.
What is it in Hungarian?
Köszönöm.
Köszönöm.
Köszönöm. Mm. And it was funny because Hungarian would come up quite a lot more often than you'd think. So it was one that I got better at than some of the others. To this day, I can't do Polish. I just can never remember. I get Polish and Czech mixed up quite a lot. But Hungarian, I'm not bad at.
Hungarian's a bit of a language all of its own, isn't it?
Yeah, it's. I'm fascinated by a lot of these things, and yeah, Hungarian is one of those ones that it shares a lot of roots with Finnish.
Hmm.
But not from any of like the surrounding countries. So that's a strange one. But yeah, like I say, it's so. Learning the differences in the way that people interact with each other, helped me get my current partner. I say current. That implies that she's not going to be. She is.
And have you been over to Hungary?
I visited Hungary before I met her.
Yeah.
Which is where
What's her name, by the way?
Her name's Edina.
Edina.
But that's actually often it would be the place where I would first learn the new way of saying thank you is I'd go to that place, and I'd normally in the concierge of the hotel or whatever, I'd be like, how do I say thank you here? And they'd say, they'd tell me, and I'd say it repeated times, and off I go.
On to the next country.
Usually off to the bar.
What about the in Hungary? You visited Budapest, or
that was the only place I've been.
Is that where Edna's from?
Yes, that's where she's from. She she was born and raised just outside, but lived in Budapest itself.
Mm.
We do plan to go back at some point if we can get my health back up to some sort of level where travel is possible.
Mm, good. Barbara and I, that's my partner, we went and had a cycling holiday on the Danube. We started off in Germany and then went through Austria.
How did you
and
manage
so
to not sink?
How many what, sorry?
How did you manage to not sink?
I don't follow. Oh, on the Danube?
Well, yeah, you had a cycling holiday on the Danube.
Close by. we thought Hungary was great to the extent that once our holiday was finished the next year, we got bikes again and just spent a whole week not following the river, but this time just exploring Budapest. It was lovely. And yeah. I like the people there as well.
Yeah. The Hungarians are they're a very interesting people, very unique culture. Their own specific thing and way of looking at the world, and some of the architecture there is absolutely stunning as well. So yeah, big fan.
And we noticed that as well, that the fact that it was compared to Vienna, it was Vienna was like a little chocolate box.
Yeah.
Budapest looked far more hard working away from the river. You could see a lot of buildings were still covered in dirt or bullet holes or whatever, but at the same time they beautiful little palaces and very impressive buildings that have been turned into art galleries and things like something that stuck in our imagination, really. Anyway, we digress. Tell me a little bit more about growing up and school and that sort of thing. Did you like school? What were your favourite subjects?
I hated school. Mm. Like all children, I hated school, but I loved childhood, and I miss childhood to the point where I purposely try to regress to it on a daily basis. I'm a child of the 80s. I feel, I firmly believe that the 80s was the best decade, mm-hmm. especially for being a child. You had the best of both worlds. You had kind of the all of the traditionalism and way of doing things from your parents and your grandparents, and things which being done properly and all of that stuff. But at the same time, you had this kind of wonder of the future and the year 2000 and flying cars and space exploration and all of that that we don't have anymore. Everything's very just, oh yeah, it's just, you know, the future. Boring.
The 60s was pretty good as well. We had moon landings and the first round of pop festivals.
Yes,
Isle of Wight, that sort of thing.
Yeah, so
and the Beatles, of course.
Of course. You did all the stuff that paved the way for the 80s to be able to then have the imagination to fly with it.
Jay, you know what it is? It's raining and I'm just wondering if it's going to be quiet. Are you happy?
I'm fine. I'm all good. I bought a T-shirt this morning, so I'm fine. I've got something to change into.
Not from the Olympus company. Let's keep going and see how we get on. So I thought that we had a pretty nice time growing up in the 60s. The 80s, yeah, that's pretty good. They had some great music as well.
The 80s was the best music, and I will fight and die on that hill.
Who's your favourite group?
See, you can't have a favourite group. It's impossible to have a favourite group because there were so many amazing groups and different genres and styles. And also, I'm very much a mood-based person. So I don't have a favourite group or a favourite song. It's whatever fits my mood at the time. Plus, the other thing that I find with right now, there's a whole new wave and genre of music that's come out lately based on the 80s style and the 80s sound. So you know, you can look up retro wave or synth wave, and these are people, artists today, that are making 80s music or the 80s sound today, and it sounds amazing, and you can literally close your eyes and be back in the 80s, but it's new modern music.
I think it's a way of doffing their cap at something that was quite remarkable, really. The amount of talent and new sounds that came out at that time.
And often dismissed. I mean, I remember growing up and, you know, and mum and dad being very dismissive of the 80s sound and 80s music, you know, and it had its own thing. It had its own thing going on, and both and there was, you can argue there's visual styles and whether you like a perm or a mullet, that's a personal choice. I wouldn't grow a mullet. I couldn't grow a mullet.
Not now, you couldn't.
No. But you know, there are people who could, and they did, and they embraced it. And they should be applauded for that.
Did you ever sort of bunk off or go off to music festivals or nights out and things like that to see bands?
No, I was a good boy.
Yeah,
I was a very good boy. I always did as I was told. Besides, it was always much more fun to stay at home and play with your Scare Electric or your Lego. It's way more fun. And I'm not going to lie, I still play with my Lego.
Just tell me a little bit about then. I'm interested to know about the jump from obviously school days, maybe student days, I don't know, but then moving into photography.
So
you stayed on at school, you did your A levels.
I did, and I went to art college, and everything I did, all of my work, I suppose, was very art oriented. Always loved taking photos, never considered it as a job or as a possible career. No one even suggested it, but it was definitely something that I was always veering towards subconsciously.
Did that take off when you were at college then?
Well, these things took off but weren't ever cultivated, or at least not to the extent they could have been, until after I'd actually got a degree in graphic design, which even my graphic design work and projects were very photographic. And then ultimately I ended up working as a graphic designer for several years. And ultimately I ended up getting made redundant, which then obviously left me out of work. I was then offered some graphic design jobs, and I suddenly had this epiphany after my last job, where I only got hired because for some reason I put a photography section in my portfolio, and my then boss had kind of spent a year cultivating this love of photography, that I was like, oh, I'm not a graphic designer, I'm a photographer. So that's what I ended up doing.
That moment of realization. Yeah. Can you, people talk about, the first LP or CD you had, or the first motorbike you had, or the first girlfriend you had, or whatever, but can you remember the first photograph that you took? If it was in the old days, it would be, you'd be in the dark room and you'd be sitting in front of a tray of chemicals as the image came up. That would stick in your mind forever, I think. But is there anything like that for you?
Here's the interesting thing. When it comes to photography and the first photograph you took, it's easy to say, oh, well, the first photograph I ever took was this, model on a beach or whatever. Mm. But it never is with photography, because it's always a photo you took as a child. Mm. Because the first photograph I remember taking was at my grandma and granddad's golden wedding anniversary. And I think I still have it somewhere, because I've been scanning lots of old photos. And it was really blurry, but it doesn't matter, because that was the first photo I took.
Heads chopped off?
I think it was just really blurry, because it was inside some club, and like I say, it was blurry. I didn't know what I was doing. It was on my dad's Instamatic camera, and that's what it was.
The photography aspect of your CV then got you a job. And what sort of work was that? Was it a particular style of photography?
I went through a few styles and genres. You can argue that the style and the way I would work didn't change too much, or at least from my perspective didn't change too much. It was very much... very much going at feeling and emotion. That was always the kind of way I like to work and capture moments and energy. But in terms of genres, it was... I did a lot of dance photography because I was connected to the dance world quite a bit. I also did a lot of car photography because I've always been a petrol head at heart. And
so this is to please you, or this is for a client?
It's always, whenever you start something, especially something creative, start with what you know, and start with the things that you enjoy. Mm. So these were things that I knew and things that I enjoyed, and I would just work with those and. Create the images within those genres that I enjoyed.
For people who don't know you or about you, then you'd start working with people, with models, or you'd be given a job of working taking photographs of a car, which became part of your job, or what?
It would vary. So, there's on occasions I'd be working for a magazine, so of course if I'm working for a magazine, then is it an article selling a product, or is it an interview, or is it showcasing something that someone's made? So it would be very, and how I would approach it would differ based on that. I think my first published cover was a car magazine for a trade. It was a trade magazine, car trade magazine. So it was, it was just images of a car.
Mm-hmm.
Then I did something at a similar time that was dance related. Then it's just, there's some people dancing and I was just capturing the actual dance routine and what that was about. So it was less about what was written next to it. It was more just about capturing the essence of the movement.
Mm. I think when we spoke before, and you mentioned this about a certain sort of magic, if you like, between the photographer and the model, perhaps as more to do with modelling, I guess. But and that's something that is, how can you say, it's something that's got to be developed between you and the person involved, their confidence on both sides and so on and so on. And that's, I guess, what makes the magic of a great photo.
Yeah, I mean, as time went on, I definitely found myself moving away from cars and dance and whatever. Yeah, it would still always inform a lot of what I did. But my heart was always in me as a photographer, or more specifically as an individual, working with a model, or again, more specifically, an individual, whether that be a fashion model or a celebrity or whatever. And the interaction between the two of us. And often I would, it would become a dance. It would become, you know, I would give her a direction of what I wanted, and then she would move. And then that would then inform me on how I would then change how my positioning to capture what I want. And it would go back and forth. And like I say, it would become a bit like a dance, to really try and create something, not necessarily new, but authentic and in the moment.
I think nowadays, for example, with cameras, with phones, you can get a pretty reasonable photograph under many quite difficult circumstances. But catching that sort of energy and catching that sort of spark, I think, is something that is a great talent.
I don't know if it's a talent, but it's definitely the sort of moment that I like to exist in.
Mm. And I think that moment is fleeting, very fleeting. And you can try and capture it, and 1 minute it's there and the next it isn't. That's the way I feel about my own photographs anyway, that we're surrounded with people or whatever it is and I'm trying to do something. So occasionally you get it, especially with children and things like that. And then it's great fun to look back at them. But that's something which I really quite envy. Anyway, you were telling me before about travel as well, and pointing proudly to your swallow. Tell me a little bit about that and how you graduated up to be best buddies with the Olympus company.
Well, I mean, I've always loved travelling, and obviously growing up with parents that worked for British Airways and in the aviation industry, that definitely added to my joy of travel, and specifically air travel. I still always insist on a window seat, always sit there looking out the window. Love takeoff and landing, taking photos of aeroplane wings out of aeroplane windows. Doesn't get old for me. And I've been doing it since...
Sorry, I
a
just
child.
Nodded off there.
No, it just does not get old for me.
Oh.
This sort of thing and this love of travel, I think it's something that a lot of people can identify with, you know, seeing far-flung places. And then as far as the Olympus thing goes, because I like travel, and I like taking photos everywhere I go, and I take photos of everything, I think I'm partly Japanese, as along with my Viking roots. Many moons ago, I decided I had all these big expensive cameras and heavy cameras that needed bags and lenses and whatnot, and I wanted something smaller that I could just carry around and just take photos as and when, and have something a little bit more as an extension of my arm, or even myself, rather than just a phone, which they're getting better. You can do amazing things with a phone, but there's still no replacement for a good camera. So I went out and bought a camera, and the best looking camera to me at the time, outside of a Leica, which I couldn't afford, was an Olympus. So I bought a little Olympus and started using that. I had a magazine article written about me, and
what was that all about?
It was about me and about the photography I was doing and all of that. And I mentioned in this interview that I was using Olympus, and they picked up on it.
They got in touch with you?
Yep, got in touch, and a show in at the NEC in Birmingham. We had a little conversation, and they just brought out a new camera, and we struck up a beautiful relationship that has endured to this day.
And when was that?
We're talking probably about 15 years ago now.
And then, in your eyes anyway, you changed up a gear, did you?
I don't know if I changed up a gear, but it definitely changed a gear. And it made me... it definitely made me change the way I looked at the possibilities of what photography could be, or at least what I could do with it. And that's still informing me to this day. Even throughout this whole cancer journey, it's made me change what it is that I'm doing, you know, on a day-to-day basis with photography, in a way that has really helped keep me going.
Mm-hmm. And is that because of the change of equipment that is available to you? I suppose anything in the Olympus range, or is that because of, I don't know, some different attitude in your head now? You've turned a corner, a new chapter?
I think there's an element of all of it. So my favourite camera that I use, and I use it, and I've got two of them, is the Olympus Pen F, and that came out in 2016. They brought out way better cameras since then. But that's the camera I love. That's the camera I reach for. And like I say, I've got two, because I've got one in black, one in silver, because why not? I've got a different lens on each of them, so it's just easier to pick up one and then the other. So that's number one. Then you've got the sort of ethos of the brand has really helped with the way I look at what's possible and what I can do. And then I think on top of that, it's just... The brand's just been really supportive of me. I do things for them, they do things for me. It's a very organic relationship that we've had.
Such as?
Some of the places I've been, some of the people I've met, some of the opportunities I've had are the things that I could only have dreamt of, and it's been a very two-way street. I've done things for them, they've done things for me. I never would have dreamt of going and spending spending 2 weeks in Galapagos in Ecuador.
I was going to ask you then to give us an example of a really delicious photo shoot that sticks in your mind.
I mean, it was wildlife, so completely out of my wheelhouse. but at the same time, you know, I can honestly say I never thought that I would ever spend a morning drinking coffee in a cloud forest, having ridden on a cable car.
There's plenty of clouds in London as well, you know.
There are plenty, but it's not often that you get to drink coffee looking down at the clouds. That's yeah.
You've risen to some heights there.
I have. So yeah, like I say.
And what was all that about, Jay? Were you taking it was a modelling session or?
No. It was wildlife. So it was completely. I mean, the brand was going in a different direction, but rather than just bin off people that they've worked with, it was you know, giving me the opportunity to. You know, and this was only in 2019, so beginning of 2019, so again right before my health decided to take a turn, and you know, and they're still supportive of me now, and I'm eternally grateful for that, and genuinely love the brand, you know, more than words could say.
Well, that's quite some tribute, isn't it? I think we've covered the ground with Olympus quite adequately there. tell me about your illness anyway. You mentioned that you took a turn for the worst about 2019. Is that during COVID or what?
So 2019 I was all right. 2020, beginning of lockdown, beginning of COVID, I started getting symptoms where it started with just gas and bloating, and I didn't think much more of it other than I'd probably just eaten something funny, but it didn't go away. Tried fixing it with diet, didn't go away. And then come sort of October, November, I started getting abdominal cramps. They didn't go away. So enough's enough, needed to go to the doctor. Did a bunch of tests, and then end of the year, they said, okay, your tests have come back bad. You need to go and have a colonoscopy, which I'd never had before. So we did that, which was an experience in itself. And after doing that, and I was sitting in this waiting area, seeing people come in and go out, come in, go out, and then eventually they wheeled me back into the room, brought my girlfriend in, and basically said, we found something, and we'd like to introduce you to the cancer nurse specialist team. And
you were in London at this time,
right? This was in London, yeah. Turns out I was diagnosed with stage 3 bowel cancer, which wasn't what we'd planned. And thankfully they caught that one early, and they managed to give me chemotherapy and surgery, followed by more chemotherapy. And come November 2021, they finished treatment, and then January 2022, so last year, they said, yep, we've got all of it, you're cancer free, which obviously was a relief. But I didn't feel right, still felt broken, and unfortunately my hunch was proven correct, because by May they then found a 5-centimeter tumor growing on my liver, which wasn't ideal. I then developed bacteremia, which is a precursor to sepsis, about a month later, where they discovered that the tumour doubled in size to 10 centimetres, which was even less than ideal. And then started me on more chemotherapy, none of which worked. And in January, February, after yet more unsuccessful treatments, they basically said nothing's working. I then developed sepsis, almost died from septic shock, and they told me that unfortunately you've probably only got 1 year left to live, which is kind of where we see ourselves now. That being said, I'm on a clinical trial, which hopefully will work. But, yeah, running out of options.
We're here at St. Joseph's. You started on a new drug regime. Last week when I spoke to you, you sounded rather down. This week you sound a lot more perky, I suppose. You'll say you have good weeks and bad weeks.
It's not easy. The thing is, it's not... My mindset is very, very stoic, and you know, for the most part, I'm pretty solid. The problem I have is I often get these... Well, I'm always in pain. There's always a lot of pain going on, and that's often difficult to deal with. Just by the nature of the amount of drugs I'm on to mitigate the pain. And I'm on a lot of different drugs. But when I sort of have good weeks and bad weeks, it's more of my ability to deal with the physical side of things. We all die eventually. That's just something that's going to happen. Am I happy about dying next year? No. Am I doing everything I can to make that not happen? Absolutely. The problem I have is time scale. If you told me that I was going to live till 50, I'd be okay with that. I can do a lot in that time. But when you say, oh, you've got until next year, that's not a lot of time. I'd like a bit more than that. It's a bit greedy, but I'd like a bit more. But it is what it is. I can't do anything to change, you know, what is the case. So I've just got to make the best of it. And I'm trying to do the best I can with that. So for now, I'm doing clinical trials. I'm trying to live every day and enjoy as much as I can about, you know, the life I have and what I do have, because I've got some amazing things. You know, you talked this morning about it raining. I enjoy the rain. I enjoy listening to proper rain and thunder and lightning. The sun's just come out. You know, all of these things are free for everyone to enjoy. And it sounds a bit hippie, but I really do enjoy so much more of what life has to offer now, in a way that I took for granted for 99% of my life.
I think we all do.
We all do, and that's where you know, I talk about, you know, going to Galapagos and stuff. And if I never get to travel again, would I be you know, would I be sad about it? I would love to travel again. If I can't, it's fine. I've done it. I've got the memories. So in many respects, I'm lucky. In fact, in most respects, I'm lucky.
You've got Edna with you, Sylvia. Yeah, I know you mentioned her earlier on. It sounds as though she's been a good sport.
She's been the best. You know, we've only been together for 4 years, and yet she's done so much. She's put up with so much. and continues to do so. She's just had to give up work to look after me, and because of some of the things that I can't do right now. She helps. She pushes me in the right way that we hope that my physical condition is going to get better to a state where I'm able to do more, and you know, and maybe we'll get to travel at least in some way. But yeah, so but for now, I mean, she's you know, I wouldn't, whether I'd be here or not if she wasn't around, I'm not entirely sure, but life would be very different if she hadn't been here for the last few years.
You sound like a guy who has ticked off a lot of things that you would set yourself as in challenges and things in life, and that's great. Anything that you want to do really badly in the next 12 months or whatever it might be that you really like to get your teeth into?
I just want to leave something behind. It's, you know, I talk about how, you know, I'd like more time. And of course, you know, we all want to live as long as possible. No one's going to live forever, but I feel that legacy is something that matters to me more than I realized it would. Because with legacy and your ability to, you know, leave something behind, you effectively get to live, maybe not forever, but for a lot longer than your mortal years.
Jay, we should have mentioned it and gone into it more fully when you were talking about your cameras and Olympus and things, but I would like you to just maybe select one little tidbit out of your great big pot of experiences, either the best shoot you've ever been on, the most satisfying, the most ridiculously awful events that took place on another one, and so on and so on, just to give people a taste of the sort of life that you've had behind the camera.
Where do I start? Okay, I'll give you a particular favourite story, just because it's just a bit silly.
You could start where it all went wrong.
No.
Have you ever started a shoot without filming the camera or something?
Oh,
like that?
I mean, we've all done stupid stuff like that. But there was an occasion where I was at home on a Thursday night. I think it was a Thursday. It was a Tuesday or a Thursday. I'm pretty sure it was a Thursday. That's completely irrelevant to the story. But so it was a Thursday night, and I was cooking a big vat of chili in my kitchen, because cooking it in the bedroom's stupid. So I get this phone call, and it's from a PR company, and they're like, Jay, are you in town at the moment? And I'm like, yeah. And like, well, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm cooking chili. And they're like, okay. Can you get down to Tower Bridge? Yeah, but like now. Sure. Okay, good. Do it. Get in a taxi now. Come down to Tower Bridge. We need you to shoot David Hasselhoff surrounded by zombies. So there's me going, okay, what am I doing with all this chili? So I turned the hob right. I mean, the good thing about chili is that you can just turn it right down and leave it cooking for hours. So you know, I put the lid back on. I turned it right down. Obviously, left a little gap with the wooden spoon, so it didn't boil over. So I left my chili there, like, simmering away. Went down to Tower Bridge, and there was a load of zombies there, and yeah, and they were like, okay, David's going to be here in like 15 minutes. You've got 15 minutes with him to get the shot, but he's in a really bad mood. If you can be done in five, then all the better. So so we worked out what we were doing. We set up and got everything ready. And when I say, like, we set up, this is me on my own with a bunch of zombies and David Hasselhoff.
Can you tell me what the occasion was at this stage, or if this has been explained to you?
I was a bit sketchy, but turns out he just released a phone game called Hoff Zombie Beach, where you play David Hasselhoff dressed as David Hasselhoff as a in his Baywatch gear, running around in kit from Knight Rider, killing zombies, as you do. And this was a promotional image. So eventually he turns up. Now I'm thinking, okay, don't meet your heroes. This is Michael Knight from Knight Rider, and Mitch Buchanan from Baywatch, all in one person. First thing is, he's really tall. He's what, 6'8" or something. He's so tall. I've got a photo with him, and I look like a midget. So it was ridiculous. So he turned up, and I'm thinking, okay, he's supposedly in a really, really bad mood, and I need to be as super quick as I can and super professional. I put my 10-year-old boy head to one side. And got my professional head on, and I did everything. And then, of course, and the shoot was way easier than I thought it was going to be. He then started directing all the zombies and be like, "You guys lie there. You guys come at me." And then eventually, like,
so any reason why it was done at Tower Bridge?
No idea. Mm. No, that yeah, never even occurred to me until just now. So we did it. And then finished, and I was like, okay, we're done, we got it. And we were done in, you know, and it went longer than the 5 minutes, because I was feeding off him, and he was clearly having a good time. And then he's like, "Oh, we're done? Does anyone want selfies?" And I'm like, I'm having a selfie. So I got a selfie with David Hasselhoff, and I'm fine with meeting my heroes, because he was amazing. 10-year-old boy still thinks he's a hero. And the chili was still good.
I thought you were going to say, and as you got into your home street, the fire brigade were there.
No.
And the alarm.
The chili was saved.
That's incredible. And it sounds like you didn't give it too much thought on the shoot.
No. It was, So that's probably my favourite story, or at least one of them.
And that's one that's gone really well.
Yeah.
But I was hoping also there might be a disaster story somewhere along
the
way.
No, we don't do disasters.
Look on the bright side.
Yeah. Exactly.
That's great.
Exactly.
Jay, it's been fantastic talking to you. I hope you covered all the ground you want to cover. I don't think we've missed anything very much out. We haven't talked about your parents at all. Perhaps you want to have a little word about them. No, that's not.
They. I'm the product of them. Everything about me is attributed to them.
Good stuff. Very nice to meet you.
And you.
The warm handshake. Now let's turn these things off.